On canvas and in marble, the founding fathers of the United States are larger than life. But what are the true stories behind these mythical men? What mysterious forces were at work that helped create the world's greatest democracy out of nothing? Like all men, the founding fathers had secrets. The clues to their underground world are everywhere, hidden in plain sight, if you know where to look. Symbols, signs, secret knowledge, and for the first time on television, the body parts one founding father never wanted you to know about. Cracks in the marble reveal a darker, more complex picture of America's most important men. These are the secrets of the founding fathers. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, and ensure domestic tranquility, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. With these words, the Founding Fathers set into motion the establishment of the United States. Mortal men who breathed life into an immortal document. But beneath their powdered wigs and painted portraits, who were they really?
Human beings are the same today as they were back with the Founding Fathers. And now we're beginning to look back and see these figures, the Founders, not as these pristine demigods, but as people with their own secrets.
They were imperfect men who formed a more perfect union. And what they did behind closed doors has remained a mystery for more than 250 years. George Washington swore his complete loyalty to Freemasonry and took the secrets of this mysterious brotherhood with him to the grave. Benjamin Franklin used his Masonic contacts to forge alliances in boardrooms and bedrooms. John Hancock fronted what some would call America's first terrorist organization.
The biggest secret of the Founding Fathers is the fact that they had an agenda, that it wasn't just things playing out on a day-to-day basis and doing good.
The Founding Fathers are portrayed as marble figures, and that they had nothing else going on in their heads besides founding a great country. But they all have ulterior motives, and which the modern historians tend to ignore.
What was that agenda? The answer may be found in exposing the secret societies, especially Freemasonry, where the founders plotted and planned a revolution and a new government.
One of the remarkable things is how many different organizations each of them belong to. And to us, looking at this, it seems kind of strange, right? What are they up to?
Whether they called it networking or diplomacy, our founding fathers dipped their pens into more than just company ink on both sides of the Atlantic. ...1770, Great Britain. Two men, a bit drunk from some home-brewed beer, make their way across an English country estate not far from London. They're heading for a secret subterranean pleasure palace. They enter a network of underground caves and chambers cut into the hillside. Awaiting them is a feast for all the senses. Fine food, excellent wine, and beautiful women ready to satisfy every taste. It's a meeting of one of England's so-called hellfire clubs. And among those who are there to indulge in every kind of sensual pleasure are British members of Parliament, ministers, chancellors, and one American, Benjamin Franklin.
I always look at it as being sort of behind the bike shed stuff. Boys will be boys. They meet together and they compare their penises and so on.
Benjamin Franklin is feeding the kind of desires shared by all powerful men: to lust, to consume, and to win. But he is also keenly aware that keeping the sexual secrets of so many important men will serve the cause of liberty.
Just as we see the human beings who are our politicians today have personal secrets, personal dirt, if you will, the same thing is true of the Founding Fathers.
In the colonies, hundreds of secret organizations are operating in the shadows, protected places where powerful men can escape and relax. There were clubs for sex and clubs for drinking. But there were also clubs for exchanging radical ideas, for plotting insurrection. They had names like Junto, Hellfire, Illuminati, but the single most influential secret society was the Freemasons.
The truth of the matter is, Freemasonry was a very important intrinsic part of the social and intellectual life of many of the founders.
The symbols of Freemasonry are everywhere. They are part of the fabric of our federal government, adorn some of our most important buildings and monuments, are even on objects we touch every single day.
And as you dig deeper, you realize how deep the roots of Freemasonry go, how they sort of connect with so many really important things.
Take a closer look at the founders, and you'll find that 9 signers of the Declaration of Independence were Masons. So were 13 of the 39 signers of the Constitution, 33 of George Washington's revolutionary generals were Freemasons. Is this a coincidence? Or evidence of a secret alliance between Freemasons and the highest levels of our government? Officially, what we know today as Freemasonry had its roots in the real Mason or stoneworker guilds of 16th century Scotland.
So in 1599 in Edinburgh, Freemasonry is operating as it was originally, a trade guild or a union. And the original secrets probably were trade secrets taught to an apprentice. And only members of the lodge were privy to the trade secrets.
These trade unions evolved, and in London, in 1717, they were officially reorganized as a social club. This incarnation of Freemasonry was based on a radical new concept that will influence a new nation across the Atlantic: the separation of church and state.
The idea that the Freemasons came up with was that men of different religious beliefs could agree that God exists. They could agree that their understanding of God compels them to do good in the community, and they could stop the religious discussion at that point. That was a radical idea, verging on heresy.
Expressing these radical ideas meant that discussions inside Freemason meetings had to remain within the Brotherhood. And over time, keeping the secrets of Freemasonry became more important than the secrets themselves.
Masonic secrets are really emblematic of honor more than anything else. When you're given a password or you're given one of the famous secret handshakes that everybody likes to make a big deal out of, and if you can't keep that tiniest, dumbest little secret, then your word can't be trusted on larger things either. It's a lesson. It isn't the secrecy itself.
When English settlers brought Freemasonry to the American colonies, the secret society became a very important way of establishing who could be trusted.
If you could establish yourself as a Freemason, you immediately established a web of support. A Freemason could travel from Charleston to Boston or vice versa and immediately find himself among a network of friends.
This network of neighborhood clubs, called lodges, disseminated the core Freemason values of separation of church and state, the equality of men, and freedom of speech. Values that the Founding Fathers seem to lift directly from the Masonic Constitution and drop right into the Constitution of the United States. Article 10, Representative Government and Majority Rule. Article 14, A System of Checks and Balances. Article 39, Masonic Government Established as a Federal System. The Mason's sphere of influence is wide and reaches deeply into America's very roots.
Freemasonry as an organization that encourages free thinking certainly produced men on both sides of the Revolution. While we as Freemasons like to point to men like Franklin and Paul Revere, George Washington, the Marquis de Lafayette, we have to keep in mind that Benedict Arnold was also a Freemason.
Since its start in America in the early 1700s, very little of the Masonic secret rituals, practices, and symbols have changed.
At a lodge meeting, there would be a ceremonial opening. It's very likely that a new member to the lodge might be pledged to join the fraternity. Afterwards, there would have been a dinner. During dinner, you can't help but imagine that the great events of the day come up in discussion. You'd hope that those discussions would be fraternal and friendly, but humans being what they are, have a way to have passions.
The Masons formed this nation. They set us upon a secret destiny, and we're going someplace, and I'm contending that place where we're going is called the Novus Ordo Seclorum, the New World Order.
Almost from the beginning, there have been attempts to expose a sinister underbelly to Freemasonry. A 19th century Freemason, Leo Taxil, is credited with being at the root of a lot of the persistent rumors that haunt the organization to this day.
He told stories of demons appearing as crocodiles at Masonic parties playing the piano, pornographic initiation scenes, and that the secret inner circle of Freemasons worshipped Lucifer.
But new evidence suggests that Taxil's made-up tales of sex and Satanism distracted attention away from the organization's real secret agenda. Were there certain families called Star Families, descended from the keepers of the Ark of the Covenant among the early Masons? And were these families using their secrets to create a grand Masonic experiment in America?
I believe on balance, from all information available, that George Washington was a member of these Star Families.
What were the secret influences that made myths out of ordinary men? Are secret societies the smoking gun of our great American experiment? For the Founding Fathers, the most influential of all the secret societies was Freemasonry. The idea that Freemasonry was a social networking club is, according to many, a very small part of the Masons' impact on the founding of the United States. They believe the organization has its roots in ancient and secret knowledge that laid out a step-by-step blueprint for the creation of the United States.
I think, on balance, there was a deliberate intention to turn this new United States of America into a Masonic experiment. They were actually, in my view, fulfilling an ancient prophecy. It was a long-term plan that went back to Old Testament times.
The good news is that the symbolism of secrecy has served the fraternity well. The bad news is that someone that doesn't like you can take your secrecy and say anything they want about you.
The great divide comes with the interpretation of the secret Masonic rituals. These rituals are based on stories about ancient stonemasons, far older than the Masons of 15th century Europe.
Where did Freemasonry begin? They started with King Solomon 3,000 years ago, the laying of the foundation stone of his temple in Jerusalem. And certain families priestly families were established that would create a world order that was good enough for Yahweh to rule over.
According to Knight and others, these special families were the first Freemasons. In biblical times, they were entrusted with the secret knowledge contained within the Ark of the Covenant. When King Solomon's temple was destroyed in 70 AD, these families took the documents within the Ark and split them up, hiding them in different locations. The documents remained hidden until the 12th century, when a group of crusaders, the Knights Templar, found some of the secret documents and brought them back to England.
Now, all of this is explained in Masonic ritual, and I myself would have poo-pooed it a few years ago, but there's an awful lot of evidence to support it being historical fact.
Knight and others believe this ancient Masonic knowledge recovered by the Knights Templar is the true Holy Grail. It's a theory they claim is supported by how the world suddenly changed upon the Crusaders' return home.
Technology began to change radically. The building skills, Chartres Cathedral, for example, flying buttresses and great skills suddenly materialized. New ideas of how to keep great buildings soaring into the skies. Where did this knowledge come from? Maybe it came from these documents. The biggest changes in the history of mankind occurred within a tiny time frame that coincided with the recovery of these documents in 1128.
And where are those documents today? Many have searched, but none have found their secret location. But Knight has startling new evidence suggesting a chilling link between the Knights Templar and at least one founding father. He believes the secret knowledge contained within the Ark of the Covenant has been handed down from generation to generation within the original Templar families. He has dubbed them Star Families because of the importance they placed on the five-pointed star, symbol of Venus, and a symbol repeated throughout the history of Freemasonry and the United States. Knight does not think this is a coincidence. Members of these families were among the first settlers in America.
I believe that these families, these star families as I call them, saw the New World as an opportunity to create from scratch, without the encumbrance of history, this New Jerusalem that had failed to fully materialize in England.
One of these families came to the shores of Massachusetts in 1666. They brought with them a family crest of five pointed stars and stripes. Their family name? Washington.
They were not economic migrants. They had no need to go. I think they were trying to do something quite special. I believe, from all the information available, that George Washington was a member of these star families.
This strange and compelling idea is seriously debated today. However, George Washington did change the world suddenly and profoundly. And no one argues he is this country's most famous Mason. George Washington was just 20 years old when he was initiated into the lodge at Fredericksburg, Virginia in 1752.
And the virtues and the ideas that he learned when he became a Freemason remained important to him his whole life.
Members of the lodge gathered near midnight under the light of the full moon. What exactly happened remains a secret within the fraternity, but Masons do reveal that the initiate would have been presented to the members in a state called neither naked nor clad.
Washington would have been divested of his civilian clothes and made sure that he wasn't having any medals or anything on him like that, that he was destitute, so to speak, when he was brought into the lodge. He would have been brought into the lodge and examined by the brothers, taken around the lodge, and each of the brothers would have asked him questions to make sure that he was who he was and that he was willing to do this of his own free will and accord. And if he agreed to those questions and he was found fit, then he would have been placed at the altar to take an obligation to the fraternity and to himself and to his brothers to uphold the rules and the goodness of the lodge and his own honor.
Then George Washington received his first lessons in the many secret signs and symbols of Freemasonry. The most important and public symbol was, and is to this day, the square and compass, the working tools of the Mason, and symbols of precision and rectitude. In the center is the letter G.
It stands for both God and geometry. God is seen as the entity that designed the whole universe. And so geometry becomes the science by which God did that. It unites faith with science. So that G is packed with all kinds of symbolism.
George Washington is given his first degree, called Entered Apprentice. To advance in the ranks of Freemasonry, the Entered Apprentice can, in time, earn more degrees, including the ritualized grilling that makes up part of the ceremony for the third degree. The ritual is how the phrase giving someone the third degree crept into common usage. George Washington completed the third degree and rose to Master Mason. He was now tied to the country's most brilliant and powerful men, the movers and shakers of his day, circulating in a secret world that embraced the ideas of these free and innovative thinkers.
The Masonic lodges were a laboratory of democracy that didn't really exist anywhere else.
It was bold and strange, and to some, sinister.
The reason why people were fearful of Freemasonry in the 1700s, it wasn't the symbolism. It wasn't the all-seeing eye or the skull and crossbones or King Solomon's temple or any of that. What they were frightened of was that these men were getting together, electing their own officers, rising through merits, discussing things about equality, discussing things that were free of the king or the pope or the priest, and making decisions of self-determination. That's what frightened people 200 years ago.
Freemasonry wasn't the only secret society the founding fathers found useful to their careers. One founding father in particular found unconventional ways to form political alliances.
He was somebody who could place himself among these French aristocrats and engage in their wild parties and their orgies and ingratiate himself to the powers that be there.
From 1730, Freemasonry was the most important and influential secret society in colonial America. But it was by no means the only one. In fact, in 18th century America, secret societies were quite in fashion, and men often belonged to a number of different clubs. Any nefarious underground activities were deeply buried under a veneer of absolute respectability.
The term secret society only became fearful when we started to have secret societies like communists and the mafia and Nazis and those sorts of people. But 100 years ago, 200 years ago, these things weren't considered frightening at all.
Our conveniences of being able to connect to people through social networking, to find out people of like minds easily at the push of a button, were not at the ready for the founders, who had to rely upon these organizations to socially connect with like-minded people.
But many secret societies also had a dark side, revealed only through whispers and rumors.
Arthur Edward Waite, in his book entitled The Real History of the Rosicrucians, here's what he wrote, quote, "Beneath the broad tide of human history, there flow the stealthy undercurrents of the secret societies, which frequently determine in the depths the changes that take place upon the surface."
And no one used the power of the secret society to better political advantage than founding father Benjamin Franklin. Ben Franklin is America's founding overachiever, From the details of his electrical experiments with a kite and key, to his printing press, and to his publication of Poor Richard's Almanac, which was a colonial bestseller for more than two decades, he had an insatiable appetite for anything new, different, or bizarre.
Benjamin Franklin is a rare figure in history. He did so much because there was so much to be done.
What's not as well known is that Benjamin Franklin had the same huge appetite in everything he did.
He was somebody who had a tremendous curiosity about life, as well as a sexual appetite that would rival anybody in American political life, from Jack Kennedy to Bill Clinton.
He belonged to dozens of 18th century clubs and societies, some benign, some with strange and even illegal practices.
He was an organization man, Franklin was, because he was a networker. He knew that's how you did things.
Benjamin Franklin's association with the Freemasons began with his initiation into St. John's Lodge of Philadelphia in 1731. In 3 years, his brother Masons elected him to the position of Grand Master in Pennsylvania. Starting in 1750, Franklin began traveling often to England and spent much of the next two decades living abroad. He participated in meetings and ceremonies at lodges in England, Scotland, and Ireland, and used his position as a Freemason to raise awareness of the issues confronting the colonies. In 1776, he was sent to France as ambassador of the United States. Shortly after his arrival, Franklin became master of the most celebrated and powerful lodge in Paris, the Lodge of the Nine Sisters. There he met many of France's most powerful political and military leaders, and wasted no time using this secret association to win favor for the American fight for liberty against the British.
And it's shortly after he becomes master of the lodge that the success of his diplomatic mission starts to be seen. Now, the interesting question to ask, was Franklin successful because the French hated the English and would do anything to support their enemies? Was Franklin successful because he was a very persuasive and influential genius? Or was Franklin successful because he was a Freemason? And I think the answer is yes.
By being a Freemason, he was able to bring in money. We needed, obviously, munitions. And, of course, this was a major advantage of being able to go to countries who already created munitions when your own country didn't have enough.
Benjamin Franklin also used another secret weapon to win friends and influence people. Sex.
He was somebody who could place himself among these French aristocrats and engage in their wild parties and their orgies and ingratiate himself to the powers that be there. Now, was he doing this purely out of his allegiance to patriotism and the American cause? No, I mean, the guy was having a good time. But nonetheless, this is part of Ben Franklin's character, a man who's tremendously aggressive in terms of getting out there and enjoying life, and also committed to these great ideals.
Benjamin Franklin used the same method to make deals in England. This is how he met the eccentric and influential Sir Francis Dashwood, founder of the notorious Hellfire Club.
The Hellfire Club, which was a secret society that was dedicated to engaging in orgies, some say devil worship. We don't really know what they were up to, but it would be the kind of organization that would appeal to a guy like Ben Franklin.
Did Franklin use a sordid sex club in the middle of the English countryside to help win the American Revolution? Benjamin Franklin was a dedicated Mason and a man of great appetites, scientific, political, sexual. And he used all of these passions to influence anyone who might help the cause of freedom. When he moved to London in 1754, his mission was to build support for an impending revolution, get money and guns, and in effect, become America's first arms dealer. He was enthusiastically received by one member of the House of Lords, Sir Francis Dashwood.
Sir Francis had been Chancellor of the Exchequer. He was a member of Parliament. He had many close connections with members of Parliament.
And when they did meet, they became very firm friends because they had so much in common. They were both public figures, they were both postmaster generals, and they were born almost in the same year. And they seemed to share many of the same ideas about religion and life in general. Ben Franklin's letters show that he spent many weeks over the years he was in England at West Wycombe, which he thought was a paradise.
These are the public faces of Franklin and Sir Francis. But privately, they shared other interests too. In one of the drawing rooms at Sir Francis's estate in West Wycombe, England, there is a small little-known portrait of Franklin. In that room, there are also some of the finest examples in the country of 18th century porn.
The 18th century is really the start of the age of media, and so what we might call dirty books start to appear. There's one called Maryland, which is an atlas, but it's an atlas which describes everything in female genital terms. John Clayland's Fanny Hill, for example, and also Hogarth was producing prints which show sexual acts. So, yes, you could describe this as the beginning of pornography.
The estate grounds themselves also pay homage to Dashwood's obsession. Scattered across the 5,000 acres are several temples dedicated to Sir Francis's worship of the flesh.
The Temple of Venus at West Wycombe is thought to represent the vagina, and 18th century accounts suggest that the layout of the grounds is like a female form lying down, as it were.
Even the family church Sir Francis designed himself holds sexual secrets. The tower is topped not with a cross, but with a hollow golden orb. There are seats inside and room for 12 people. There are small observation ports, and rumors abound that this orb was one of Dashwood's sexual playpens.
There are rumors that there were orgies inside the golden ball. There is no documentary evidence he ever took a woman up there, though most likely he did, as suggested that he met a pretty lady and said, "Come up and see my balls."
And within sight of the manor house, a Gothic entryway to what many believe was a sexual netherworld, the Hellfire Caves. This is rumored to be the meeting place for Ben Franklin and other elite members of Sir Francis's Hellfire Club.
Sir Francis Dashwood started what became to be known as the Hellfire Club, which was a fascinating, creepy sex club that was meeting out in the countryside.
They would take whole days, whole weeks off and go to a retreat and indulge themselves.
The caves were originally dug to provide materials for local road construction. But sometime during Sir Francis Dashwood's lifetime, secret rooms and tunnels were added to the caves. The mystery about why this was done has endured for more than 250 years. Many people believe that these underground caves were created to indulge the Lord's known passion for sex and the occult.
Well, there's really no doubt. The gentlemen that were associated with the club were men of great privilege, and with that privilege comes the capacity for them to entertain themselves in a manner in which they choose.
They do seem to have been indulging in much extreme sexuality. Sex was obviously a big part of these clubs.
They're just the most interesting and important men of the day, and socially they get together and do what they'd like to do.
Because the Hellfire Club was so secretive, much of what took place in these caves remains a mystery. At the end of the cave system is a chamber known as the Inner Temple, reserved for elite members only.
The members that were part of the Inner Circle were truly secretive. And so whilst there might have been very many members of the Hellfire Club, only those that were part of the Inner Circle were entitled to be a part of certain ceremonies. They were kept very secret from the rest of the members. And because this particular area was off limits to others, we don't really know what happened here.
Benjamin Franklin's participation in the Hellfire Club is hotly debated. Franklin does write that he has been below ground at West Wickham, but gives no details. There is a cave called the Ben Franklin Cave, but this is a modern invention. However, for more than two centuries, people have reported seeing ghostly apparitions and feeling the presence of 18th century spirits inside the Hellfire Caves.
Well, I believe in this cave system, we've got lots of residual energy, sort of like echoes of the past. There may be active spirits here. We do believe that.
For the first time on television, a full-scale paranormal investigation was mounted inside the Hellfire Caves in West Wickham, England. Investigators from the Ghost Finder Paranormal Society pooled their resources to bring in the most technologically sophisticated equipment available in the fledgling science of ghost hunting.
We all have a sense the spirits are here, but we can spend a whole lifetime searching for this phenomena and never find anything, because it is difficult to capture these things on camera and on video as well.
What they found is chilling. The team concentrated on three investigative methods. Digital photography, both still and video, audio recording, and electromagnetic anomaly collection.
Any electromagnetic fields which scientists believe spirits can control will make this start to move. So when you ask a question, hopefully if the spirit comes close to this, it will get stronger and stronger. If you've got a real strong spirit, it will go right to the top.
Are there any spirit persons present with us in the cave now?
Suddenly, as if in answer to the investigators' questions, anomalous light orbs appeared on one of the infrared camera monitors.
Almost like three light anomalies, if you want to call them orbs, spirits manifesting, just going around their legs, going around their bodies. We've got it on the hard disk, so I've never seen nothing like that, Barry.
Which tunnel seems most active at the moment?
It's hard to say, really.
During the six-hour investigation, more than two dozen eerie examples of possible spirit energy were recorded.
There we go. That was amazing.
That was a big one. Yeah. That's going vertical.
And it seems going across the
majority of them.
And there's
another
one. The majority of them are in front of camera four, I think they
are. Yeah.
I think that those lights are the first manifestations of some of the spiritual energy that is active here. As yet, we haven't figured out who it is, and that's what we plan to try and find out.
Veteran ghost hunters believe that the playful nature of the lights indicates a playful spirit energy reaching from the grave.
And I think that if Ben Franklin really had this quirky sense of humour and loved playing pranks on people, then if he's here now, then surely that's going to be his way.
It may take more tangible evidence than this to conclusively prove that Benjamin Franklin was indeed a member of the Hellfire Club, although there's evidence the blasphemous sex den was imported to America.
There appear to have been tavern rumors that even if they weren't called Hellfire Clubs, similar clubs did exist in colonial America.
And more startling, a gruesome discovery is made in Ben Franklin's basement and revealed for the first time on television. Is there proof that Benjamin Franklin was secretly participating in England's orgiastic Hellfire Club to advance the American Revolution? There is some evidence that Hellfire Clubs were imported to America.
There appear to have been tavern rumors that even if they weren't called Hellfire Clubs, similar clubs did exist in colonial America. There are accounts that people were actually arrested for hiring young girls and getting them to strip naked so that they could look at them. And possibly a version of the club for transvestites as well.
And at least one of these clubs was linked to James Franklin, Ben Franklin's older brother.
James was accused of being a member of a Hellfire Club. And it was James who actually printed in New England Courant the copy of Appleby's journal which described Hellfire Club in fairly graphic detail.
While it's a tenuous connection between Ben Franklin and the sexual deviance of the Hellfire Clubs, there's nothing debatable about the Founding Fathers' connection to this. In 1998, workmen in the basement of Ben Franklin's London home found a human bone. They dug deeper and found more bones and more. Fingers, skulls of men, women, children. Altogether, they discovered over 1,000 different body parts. Franklin's home was an illegal dumping ground for human remains.
We found almost 1,200 pieces of people, one of which was a fetal skeleton.
This was the London home of Founding Father Benjamin Franklin for 16 years. And sometime during his stay here, all those body parts ended up here too. Real skeletons in Franklin's closet. His home on Craven Street was just steps away from the Thames and also Trafalgar Square, where on any given Saturday, a man could amuse himself with a cockfight or a public hanging.
He came in July of 1757. This was a good place for him to be, given what his initial mission was, which was to negotiate with the Penn family, who were the proprietary owners of Pennsylvania. They lived just around the corner.
But very quickly, the house became a gathering place for all sorts of interesting people.
Anyone who was anyone paid a visit to Benjamin Franklin here. It can be considered the first de facto American embassy.
Franklin was also something of a matchmaker. He had a strong attachment to Polly Stevenson, the daughter of his landlady. He introduced her to William Hewson, a brilliant and handsome young scientist, and the two were married in 1770. Hewson was an accomplished medical researcher. Hewson's work on anatomy intrigued Franklin. In fact, Franklin opened his home to the young doctor. And before long, Hewson was running an entire anatomy school out of Franklin's backyard.
Anatomy did not become officially legal until the latter part of the 19th century. It probably was not very well known, the degree of dissection that was happening here at Craven Street.
Ben Franklin was breaking the law. If his gruesome and illegal support for Hewson had been discovered, it would have spelled disaster for the revolution. The fabric of his diplomatic connections would have unraveled instantly in the face of such a bizarre scandal.
We found almost 1,200 pieces of people, which are the remnants of the Hewson Anatomy School, and they were teaching some very interesting things about medical procedure.
Hewson and Franklin needed a consistent supply of fresh bodies for their many dissections and experiments. But since these experiments were illegal at the time, they had to obtain corpses through sly and secret deals.
There were some cases of student anatomists who, on drunken escapades, were able to procure bodies directly themselves, but I think that the majority probably came from established sources.
Those established sources were shady characters known as resurrectionists. These were men who were in the human remains business full-time. They'd stake out graveyards during a burial, and after hours, they'd quietly dig up the corpse and cart it away. The proximity of Ben Franklin's house to the River Thames made it an easy destination for a grave robber hawking a freshly dug up corpse. There's no record of how much Franklin or Hewson would have paid, but fresh corpses were more expensive than older ones. The Franklin House Conservation Committee allowed only a 3-foot square pit to be excavated. In that small area, they found nearly 1,200 human remains.
We didn't want to turn the rest of Franklin's basement into an archaeology site, but presumably there are many other remains that still exist beyond that one area where the bones were found.
And while Ben Franklin was in England and France making secret political deals, indulging the flesh, in championing young scientists with a taste for dismemberment, the colonies moved closer to the brink of war. On the eve of the American Revolution, secret societies were at the heart of the birth of a nation. All the founding fathers were using underhanded means and backroom deals to implement their great democratic experiment.
They were the insurgents. They were the terrorists. They were trying to overthrow the establishment. I mean, in reality, that's what they were.
And unlike the heroic portrayals of revolution, Masons Sam Adams and John Hancock played dirty to secure independence for the colonies.
They were the ones that would burn the houses down. They were the ones that would drag out the Tories, tar and feather them, and ride them out of town on a rail. They would go to newspapers who were not backing the revolution, and then they would break their printing presses.
They were also Freemasons. Midnight, 1773. The Green Dragon Tavern, a bar and Masonic lodge, is closed, but a faint light in a back room reveals men, including Masons John Hancock and Joseph Warren, are leading a secret meeting. They're planning a party, a Boston tea party.
The Green Dragon Tavern, which was sort of ground zero for revolutionary planning in Boston.
So it was definitely a conspiracy by a secret organization that got the American Revolution going.
And in 1776, when the Founding Fathers gathered to sign the Declaration of Independence, that same secret organization shadowed every move the Founding Fathers made. Who decided where, when, and how these building blocks of freedom should be laid? What symbols of their secret allegiances might be hidden in plain sight? The cornerstone of Philadelphia's Independence Hall was laid by Freemasons in 1734, built on land purchased by Mason William Allen, surveyed by Mason Edmund Woolley, erected by Mason Thomas Bode. And when the Liberty Bell tolled on July 8th, 1776, It was rung by Andrew McNair, a Mason.
There is something very odd that those people came together at that time, almost as though, if you were prone to believe such things, that God wanted it that way.
And for the last two centuries, historians and researchers have uncovered stories, hints that the final words of encouragement that pushed the Founding Fathers to sign the Declaration came from a mysterious otherworldly figure circulating in the gallery.
An individual, whom they called the Professor, stood up in the balcony and told them, look, this is it. You've got to do it.
No one was ever able to identify the Professor. He disappeared as quickly as he had arrived. Could it be that the signing of the Declaration of Independence came at the urging of a figure from another realm?
I believe it is possible for an individual without a physical body to influence a being that has a physical body. In other words, they used to call that overshadowing, and I believe that happened.
Another important and rarely discussed influence on the founders was their addiction to mind-altering substances.
Well, it's important to understand that in the 18th century, drinking water could be downright dangerous, and it might actually kill you because of the parasites that were in tainted water supplies. So it's not unreasonable to think that the big ideas and the kind of revolutionary fervor that emerges out of secret meetings that are plied with alcohol was fed by booze.
I think that the Founding Fathers must have been stoned and plastered during that whole period.
Beer, whiskey, and wine flowed freely. But was another kind of contraband fueling a new America? Hemp, early American marijuana.
When I found out about hemp, it was totally a surprise. The Declaration of Independence was drafted on hemp paper. The Constitution is printed on hemp paper also. And so are most of our early founding documents from all the states. That thin, crisp paper that Bibles are printed on, that's hemp paper. In addition to our documents, our first flag was on sailcloth, all of which was made from hemp.
Even the clothes on the colonials' backs were made from hemp.
It was a very patriotic thing during the war to be clothed in homespun. Benjamin Franklin, the whole idea was when he went to Europe and was wearing homespun, that was hemp. That was 100% hemp. Homespun has never been anything but hemp.
The Founding Fathers all grew hemp. Thomas Jefferson not only invented a new method for breaking down the fibers in the plant, he brought back newer and stronger strains from a seed-collecting trip to France.
Thomas Jefferson actually said, there's no greater thing you can do for a country than to add a useful plant to its culture. He was probably looking all over the world for the right hemp to grow in Virginia. He was really into hemp. George Washington said many times over, make the most of the hemp seed and grow it everywhere. He had a 40 acres in the south of his property that grew hemp.
Hemp was the single most useful crop in colonial America.
Sails, ropes, flags, banners, uniforms, logbooks, all that was made out of hemp. So it took 80 tons of hemp to outfit one sailing ship. And that 80 tons meant 350 acres of hemp had to be grown just for one sailing ship.
But were they smoking it?
A banned substance today, a plant that gets you high, was something that was smoked regularly by the Founding Fathers.
So the whole, you know, the Founding Fathers, in addition to being drunk all the time, may have been high.
But ultimately, the drug the Founding Fathers had the most success with wasn't hemp. It was tobacco.
We know now that tobacco is like the most addictive drug there is. And we got England hooked on it, and they loved it, and they couldn't have enough. Two or three times as much money could be made by growing tobacco. So tobacco was the number one crop in early America, and really, drugs started our country.
Besides hemp production, George Washington had other secrets too that paint a far different picture than the classic poses we are so familiar with.
George Washington had a tremendous reputation, both as a leader on the battlefield and as a lover in the bedroom.
From my research, I found indeed there was a group that I call the Founding Girlfriends. There were at least 9 women during the war who could say in all honesty that George Washington slept here.
One of Washington's supposed lovers was Kitty Green, the wife of Nathaniel Green, one of Washington's most trusted generals.
She was like, a Revolutionary War groupie. She always went to the battles, and Nathaniel Green was telling her, stay home like the other wives.
At 6'2", Washington towered above most men of his day. He was an imposing figure and magnetic on the dance floor. This is Kitty Green's dance card from one particular ball during the Revolutionary War. Every dance was promised to General Washington. Strangely, this is the same night Kitty's husband, General Green, was called away by Washington for a secret midnight mission to meet a man in a distant county. The man never showed up, and Green wrote it was a wild goose chase.
Now, there are those who imply that there was some hanky-panky going on, and there are others who might say that Washington was merely discussing his strategy for the next battle with Kitty Green. 2 points of view. But I, being a humanist, think that Washington, having been away from Martha for so long, may have had other thoughts other than the campaign strategy.
And do the Founding Fathers also have hidden agendas at work in our most sacred documents?
It's no accident that Masons are there and that they're heavily involved.
In 1787, the Founding Fathers gather in Philadelphia to hash out the most important and dangerous document in the history of the United States. This document, founded on an act of treason, will be the foundation, the moral and political vision for a new nation. And all of the secrets, their deep thinking about spiritual matters, their ties to secret societies, their altered states of consciousness, all converged to create the United States of America.
The Founding Fathers didn't just dream this up out of thin air.
Throughout, the influence of one particular group permeates Independence Hall. Is the secret vision of a new world order finally being realized by the Founding Fathers?
It's no accident that Masons are there and that they're heavily involved.
It is a fact that many Masonic concepts and the actual functioning of the Masonic system really did make its way into the Constitution.
At the time, there is already a kind of democratic constitution that exists in America. It's the Anderson Masonic Constitution of 1723.
There's no evidence that there was direct influence. But if sitting in their own backyard is a functioning federal government of whatever form, it cannot help but have been some influence.
The Freemasons' Constitution specifically spelled out separation of church and state, and so did the U.S. Constitution. A system of checks and balances, so did the U.S. Constitution. One man, one vote. Same in the U.S. Constitution.
13 of the 39 signers of the Constitution were Masons. It's not important that Freemasons made up a bulk of the Founding Fathers. What is important is that Freemasonry was influencing so many of them.
The idealized portraits of the constitutional conventions don't capture what was really going on. The men in the portraits of this gathering are solemn, reverent, civil. But in reality, there was fighting, gossiping, backdoor deals, and all in total lockdown. The Masonic ideal was in place, secrecy at all costs. It was as if they would stop at nothing to realize their vision of a new world order.
They kept it secret to the point where they boarded up the windows, kept the windows closed, kept the doors locked.
It was hot. Personal hygiene was at a minimum, and those wigs and waistcoats were uncomfortable. There were hordes of mosquitoes. The hall was noisy, choked with smoke, and people were sleep deprived.
You know, you don't do your best thinking when you're tired.
Cranky founding fathers were suspicious, even of each other.
Washington had sentries placed around Independence Hall to make sure nobody was listening. You could easily call the Constitutional Convention a conspiracy.
And one founding father required special attention. Benjamin Franklin was secretly followed by spies working for the other founding fathers because Franklin talked too much in public about top secret political matters.
And so there was always a delegate with Ben Franklin when he went out to just make sure he didn't spill the beans on the entire enterprise.
According to some, the real conspiracy at the heart of the convention was not nearly so benign. It was the wording in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18.
Congress shall have the power to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever. Notice those are the exact same words as are in the Declaration, to be the very definition of tyranny. And yet 11 years later, the same Masons are now giving that power to Congress. They gave Congress tyrannical power. That's why they did it in secret.
And when it came time to sign the nation's most important document, was the date of the signing delayed to coincide with a mysterious force secretly guiding the founding fathers? Was it a coincidence they delayed the signing until Venus was in an astrologically favorable position?
Venus and Mercury were rising in Virgo at that time. I think that date was very auspicious for them. This isn't something that happens very often at all. They pick their days very, very carefully.
And when the first president of the United States was sworn in 18 months later, those same mysterious forces were still in play behind the scenes. George Washington was sworn in on April 30th, 1789. After taking the oath of office, he bent down and kissed the Bible. The Bible came from the Capitol's closest Masonic chapter, St. John's Lodge. But more importantly, the act of kissing the Bible comes directly from the secret Masonic initiation ritual.
He is certainly not someone who was ashamed of that. He is willing to do this publicly, you know, during his presidency. So it's clearly significant for him.
Washington took his Masonic connection a step further by posing for an official presidential portrait in full Masonic regalia. And when it came time to select the symbols for the new United States of America, striking similarities emerged. Had it all been planned this way from the very beginning?
What these families were trying to do was create a world order, in the true sense of the word, order.
Were the founding fathers stealing from the playbook of the Freemasons to signal the establishment of this new world order?
When it comes to secrecy and conspiracy, we come to the Holy Grail, the Great Seal of the United States.
The the single most mysterious American icon is the Great Seal of the United States. The symbols of an unfinished pyramid, the all-seeing eye, unlucky number 13 in arrows, leaves, stripes. Latin phrases that seem to hint at a nefarious New World Order. All of it together seems to point to a strange, almost occult connection. It is a connection made between the Great Seal and Freemasonry. Is the seal proof of a Masonic conspiracy?
Unfortunately, the Great Seal is one of the least Masonic symbols you could probably find.
Of the dozen or so people who were involved in the design committees for the Great Seal, only one, Benjamin Franklin, was a Mason, and no one liked the design he and Thomas Jefferson came up with.
And they came up with a concept that involved an Egyptian pharaoh chasing the Israelites across the Red Sea and a column of fire, meaning divine intervention, that God intervened and saved us in a difficult situation. The motto was, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God.
Everyone hated it, except Thomas Jefferson, who adopted the motto for his own personal seal. The Great Seal required congressional authorization, and getting anything past an entire Congress takes time.
It would take 6 years and three different committees to get this done. But when it was finally done, it represented what we thought America's ideals were.
The front of the seal is called the obverse, the side most commonly seen, and the side imprinted on America's most precious documents. The symbols of an eagle, arrows, and an olive branch, a shield of stripes, and a heavenly crown of stars, enduring American symbols, are familiar to us now. But this obverse wasn't adopted until 100 years after the design the Founding Fathers agreed on, in 1782.
This is the first Great Seal of the United States, created and approved on August the 20th, 1782. And I want you to note these six pointed stars. This did not happen. It did not reoccur with the other seals that were created afterward.
In heraldry, a six-pointed star represents the heavens, a five-pointed star, the earth. What secret hand wanted to take our national symbol out of the spiritual realm is unknown. The original bird was also distinctly different.
In actuality, of course, it is an American eagle, but it was an American bald eagle. You can see here that the eagle's neck is elongated, and that's why a lot of people thought that this wasn't an eagle, but a phoenix, especially when you see a little tuft of hair. But many eagles have that tuft of hair, except for the bald eagle.
But not everyone sees the symbols as simply patriotic.
Those symbols reveal our future, and I call it America's secret destiny. And I started becoming concerned about that. And when I did, I found the trackings of the Masonic Lodge.
Look carefully at the eagle.
If you look at the eagle's left wing and count the feathers on that wing, there's 32 of them. And on the right wing, there's 33. The eagle doesn't have odd number of feathers. That's not by accident, that's by design. And you'll notice that it's the right wing of the eagle that the eagle's looking towards, and that's the one with 33 on it. And the 33rd degree inside the Masonic Lodge runs the whole thing worldwide.
Is this a secret symbol that 33 is the only right number? Is it a coincidence that the 33rd degree is the highest level a Freemason can attain? And as far as numbers go, the startling use of the number 13 also seems to be about more than just a tribute to the original colonies.
The Masons discuss the mystical number 13. It's significant to them. The people that founded this nation knew that the number 13 had Masonic significance, and it was the Masons who set this nation up. There are 13 leaves in the olive branches in the Great Seal, 13 bars and stripes, 13 arrows, 13 stars in the crest. The American eagle is our national bird. Those two words, American Eagle, have 13 letters. The words E Pluribus Unum also have 13 letters. The two words Annuit Septus have 13 letters.
The 13 letters in Annuit Coeptis is only the beginning of the controversy surrounding the reverse of the Great Seal. The unfinished pyramid and all-seeing eye have been identified with the Freemasons for centuries.
The pyramid represents this conspiracy that the Masons are part of a 6,000-year-old religion called the Ancient Mystery Religion. This is not something just popped up in 1776. This is 6,000 years old.
A secret message perhaps linked to the original star families, or what is also called the Order of the Quest.
The Order of the Quest that came here in the 1600s, they teach their children who teach their children who teach their children, and it passes on from generation to generation.
Naysayers point out the pyramid and all-seeing eye didn't appear publicly on money until the 20th century, diluting the symbol's real influence. But this is the same symbol printed on a U.S. $40 note, dated 1778.
The first time we see the all-seeing eye is on the $40 note, where the eye is depicted looking down on 13 stars, representing 13 colonies. And on that note is Confederation. The pyramid first makes its appearance on the $50 bill, and it is a pyramid composed of 13 steps. It's not finished. The Latin translates to everlasting. So what we're getting is clues about what they were thinking, that we want to build something permanent out of these 13 colonies.
And who designed and printed these banknotes? Freemason Benjamin Franklin.
Problem is, the unfinished pyramid isn't a Masonic symbol. It does not appear anywhere in Freemasonry.
Except on the top of the headquarters of the Supreme Council of Scottish Rite Freemasonry.
Conspiracy theorists frequently point to this building, the headquarters of the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite, as part of this big Masonic conspiracy because the roof has an unfinished pyramid on it. Well, it really isn't an unfinished pyramid. This building is actually designed after the mausoleum at Halicarnassus, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world.
The symbols of Egypt are symbols of timelessness. The pyramids have endured for ages. The Sphinx has endured for ages. A symbol of human accomplishment that is enduring. And in that sense, the pyramid and Egyptian symbology is very useful in teaching those lessons.
But look closely, because there is one secret in this building that does, without a doubt, reveal the Masons' power over the government.
Because 33 is a symbolic number within Scottish Rite Freemasonry, the Supreme Council worked with the post office to sort of rejigger the addresses here so that 33 would actually be in the street number.
The pyramid may not be an official Masonic symbol, but the all-seeing eye is clearly part of Masonic symbology, adorning paintings and Masonic regalia, including Washington's Mason's apron.
That's a great way to demonstrate the all-seeing power of God looking over the world. I find it curious that people try and make that into something sinister.
The all-seeing eye, according to the Masons, stands for the ubiquity of Masonic law, which means it's worldwide. The eye sees everything everywhere, and you can't hide from the Masons. When you join the Masons, you do it for life. You can't avoid it or escape it. It's there, and it is.
If it is not a Masonic directive, then where did Benjamin Franklin get the inspiration for these designs?
Many of them were taken from a book printed in the 1600s, a European book that Franklin had in his library.
The real secret, say experts, is that original designs were expensive and printers were cheap. They stole designs out of this early American version of clip art, a real book of secrets, so to speak.
The symbols on the Great Seal, look spooky now, but they weren't spooky then. We are imposing our own meanings on them and giving them a nefarious quality that really is not based in reality.
But claims of a worldwide Masonic conspiracy persist to this day.
They put those symbols in there so that other Masons can see it, and then you can use it as a way of saying, listen, we're the ones that set this nation on a course for America's secret destiny, which is the Novus Ordo Seclorum, the New World Order.
Further evidence comes in the form of a puzzle within the Great Seal. Look at the 13 stars above the eagle's head. Use them to draw a six-pointed star. Now transfer that star to the unfinished pyramid on the reverse. Five of the points point to the letters A, S, N, O, and M.
If you take A, S, N, O, M, and re-scramble it, you get M-A-S-O-N, which clearly shows that the Masons have concealed their involvement in writing and designing the Great Seal of the United States.
Pretty creepy stuff. Of course, you can also make Ottoman, despot, accordionist, misconception. You can make a lot of words using the letters of the motto on the Great Seal.
The secret message, M-A-S-O-N, however, is clearly there, and not all Freemasons are privy to the inner circle who placed it there.
People that you interview that are Masons won't tell you about the second layer because they know about it, and they are sworn by an oath that they are not to reveal any secrets or details of this second layer. Our founding fathers were part of an ancient, I'll use the word conspiracy, and they knew about it, and they committed this nation to a furtherance of that.
There are two types of people that promote this theory. One are the conspiracists that always want to see someone else responsible for their problems. And the other people, sadly, are misinformed Masons. Because it is with some pride you can draw out a dollar bill, point to the Great Seal on the back and say, you see the eye? My fraternity was responsible for that. Well-intentioned, but uninformed.
The seal is a clue to what the founding fathers wanted to say about America. And other clues are hidden everywhere in Washington, D.C., hidden in plain sight. This is the city the founders designed from scratch, a sandbox they could fill up with symbols, signs, and secrets.
If you look at the entire map of it by itself, you can see squares and compasses everywhere.
In 1789, the design and construction of the federal city, the new nation's capital, began. As president and the most powerful Freemason in the land, George Washington had the power to mold the nation's capital to his will.
He was given a complete wilderness and the opportunity to start from scratch to build one of the great capitals of the world.
The first step was to set boundary markers for what came to be known as the District of Columbia. The district was set up like a diamond, 10 miles on a side. New boundary markers were laid every mile along its borders. Some boundary markers are still there.
The boundary markers became the very first national monuments.
The most important, the southernmost stone in Alexandria, Virginia, was laid first. It was done with great fanfare and ceremony, a Masonic ceremony.
On March 15, 1791, the Freemasons formed a procession here in front of Gadsby's Tavern to go and march south to where the foundation stone of the District of Columbia would be laid. Gadsby's was the center of social life in Alexandria. It was really built by speculators who thought that the federal city would be centered right here. And so Gadsby's was really the only game in town to go to.
The procession worked its way to the water's edge, and with Masonic jewels of office glittering in the sun, and a silver trowel to set the stone, the country's first national monument was set into place. Today, the stone is almost impossible to find amid the trash and tide.
It's fitting that the first secret of Washington, D.C. is actually this foundation stone. It sits forgotten along the banks of the river, buried underneath this lighthouse with nothing to show you where it is. In its time, it was the most important thing for the founding of this great city, and now it sits here long forgotten.
The design for the city's streets and monuments was put in the hands of Pierre-Charles L'Enfant. L'Enfant was not a mason, but his design of a grid pattern overlaid with circles and diagonals has fueled two centuries of speculation about what secret messages are hidden in the streets of D.C. The largest and most pronounced is the Masonic symbol of the square and compass. The square overlays the streets bordering the Capitol building, and the two legs of the compass lead along Maryland Avenue in the direction of the Jefferson Memorial and Pennsylvania Avenue, leading directly to the White House.
If you look at the entire map of it by itself, you can see squares and compasses everywhere. In fact, there's a five-pointed star over the White House.
It's ridiculous to think that the Masons designed the square and compass into the streets here because, number one, the square wasn't even here. Those two streets weren't even here. And they don't even form a square. It's an 85-degree angle. It's ridiculous.
The square and the compass and the star are not complete, and that's true. And that's what the Masons tell you. And that is their way that they can get us to believe that it's not real when it really is. And I'm saying that this was all by design.
If you design a grid pattern and then start putting diagonal lines across that grid pattern, it's inevitable that you will start making Stars of David, you'll make pentagrams, you'll have these odd angles. This was not some sort of evil, dark, satanic design.
The Masonic Temple, the 33rd degree Masonic Temple, is exactly 13 blocks north of the White House. I don't think that's a coincidence.
And not every scholar rules out the possibility that the designs are intentional.
The pentagram, which in our mindset has an evil connotation, to an Enlightenment architect would be a symbol of balance. And if you could put that into a street plan that was to create a rational federal city that would be the seat of rational government, so much the better. So even if there is intention behind it, it is not necessarily bad or evil intention.
The only thing I see satanic in the street plans of Washington are the traffic circles when you try to navigate them in rush hour.
At least one geometric design was specifically laid out by L'Enfant with Washington's approval. It is the Federal Triangle.
We're at the heart, the very foundation of the design of Washington, D.C., with the Capitol building to my left. We're standing at the Washington Monument, and behind me is the White House. And from these three buildings, the entire city of Washington, D.C. was planned. Charles L'Enfant laid it out basically to mean the Pythagorean right triangle, which contains a very sacred formula for beauty and the foundation of architecture.
The formula is called the Golden Ratio, the ratio of 1 to 1.61803. It is a formula artists have secretly used for eons to create the world's most aesthetically pleasing monuments and buildings, everything from the Parthenon to our nation's most important monuments.
That was a sacred formula, and it was kept secret.
There are also secrets in each of the three buildings that make up the Federal Triangle. The White House was designed by James Hoban, a Freemason in Washington's Lodge. Some believe Hoban's design of the White House was inspired by the chapel at Roslyn, the chapel where the Knights Templar supposedly buried their secrets, secrets that George Washington has access to as a descendant of these so-called star families. The Washington Monuments architect, Robert Mills, a Freemason, based his design on an ancient Egyptian symbol of power, the obelisk. The Washington Monument symbolism has been hotly debated since its erection in 1848.
Fundamentalists thought anything that is a penis that sticks up out of the ground this high is trying to pull down the energies from above into the earth. So their feeling was some occult black magic was being performed by those who created this monument intentionally.
Provocative theories aside, this is one place where Masonic influence seems undeniable. Its height is exactly 555 feet.
555 to the Freemasons symbolizes the builder, and George Washington is the builder of our country. So I think symbolically, this is one of the most fantastic of all of the symbols that we have for the United States.
And at the top, a 13-step pyramid. But this one is completed.
To them, they were saying George Washington completed his work.
The Capitol, the third point in the sacred federal triangle, has its very origin in a Masonic ceremony.
For a group that gets labeled as a secret society, the cornerstone ceremonies are very, very public affairs.
Perhaps the most significant Masonic event in this country was the laying of the cornerstone of the United States Capitol in 1793, only a few years after the Revolution. And presiding over that impressive ceremony was George Washington, wearing his master's apron.
The first great building of the new nation, what Thomas Jefferson calls the first temple dedicated to the sovereignty of the people. The Masons are the people who are dedicating it. You don't have an aristocracy. You don't have a monarch. So Freemasons become the leaders of this nation.
They were all dressed in their Masonic aprons. Special tools had been crafted just for this occasion. A trowel made out of silver was used to spread the cement on the cornerstone. A special gavel was made out of marble to ceremonially tap the cornerstone into place. They knew what they were doing was a very, very important moment in the construction of the city.
And where is that most important cornerstone today?
The only real secret about the cornerstone today is that we don't know where it is. It's been lost. It's buried up there somewhere in the foundation of the North Wing. And it's been lost because of so many remodelings that have been done over the years.
And if there is, finally, a book of secrets, our national treasure, that will once and for all unravel the mysteries and end the debate, it should be here. The Library of Congress.
It is the largest library in the world. We have well over 140 million items here. Many of the materials that we would associate with the beginnings of this country are in fact housed at the Library of Congress.
The reason why America has the world's largest repository of information is because of this founding father.
Thomas Jefferson sold his book collection to the American people. For whatever price Congress was willing to pay, his collection was massive, 6,487 volumes. It was essentially the Enlightenment in all areas, all subjects, and it really set the path for the current Library of Congress.
The founding fathers have their personal and presidential papers here. There are diaries, calendars, and letters. Many secrets are hidden here. But where is the master key that will turn all the locks of American history?
There's a notion that hidden away in the Library of Congress is what is called the Book of Secrets, detailing the truth behind many incidents and secrets that have been part of our nation's history. I'm here to tell you that we indeed do have a Book of Secrets. Unfortunately, this is a self-help book published in 1902. That tells you how to guide yourself through the world and doesn't answer any of the questions you'd like it to answer. The real truth is that there is no Book of Secrets here at the Library of Congress.
Or is there?
I would suggest that the entire Library of Congress could be seen as the Book of Secrets. Because in our collections, our vast collections, from the beginning of the founding of the nation forward, we have the materials that are about the shaping and building and experience of the American people. And I think almost any question that one approaches our collections with can find an answer.
Without a single Book of Secrets, we're left